Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are looking at a creature I like to call a theatrical zombie.
A theatrical zombie. That's a new one for me. Are we talking about a play that eats brains?
Not exactly. Yeah. I mean, a show that just it refuses to stay dead. Mm. We are digging into Beetlejuice, the musical.
Okay. That makes more sense.
And I don't just mean the plot, which is, you know, obviously about the afterlife.
Yeah.
I mean the production history itself. Because you look at the timeline we have here from 2018 up to right now, February 2026, this show has been killed off more times than a horror movie villain.
It's a fascinating anomaly. It really is. If you just look at the traditional metrics for what makes a Broadway show a success, you know, big critical reviews, the theater contracts, this show should have been a footnote. It should have faded away years ago.
But it didn't. We have a whole stack of production notes, financial reports, reception history. So our mission today is to figure out how a musical that got evicted, literally kicked out of its theater while breaking box office records, managed to build a cult following so massive that it came back to Broadway not once, but twice.
It completely challenges the old business model of modern theater, doesn't it? We're really seeing this shift from, like, the critics decide what's good to the internet decides what stays.
So let's start with the adaptation itself. Most people, when they think Beetlejuice, they've got that 1988 Tim Burton movie burned into their brain.
Lael Keaton, the striped suit, the whole shrimp cocktail scene, yeah.
Exactly. But you can't just put the movie on stage and expect it to work.
And they didn't. This is a crucial point.
Yep.
Tim Burton wasn't actually involved in the stage production. The creative team, that was composer Eddie Perfect, with the book by Scott Brown and Anthony King, they took the source material and basically remixed it.
Eddie Perfect is an interesting choice. He's an Australian comedian, a musician, not what you'd call a traditional Broadway composer.
And you can totally hear that in the score. This is one of the first things we really need to get into, the sound of the show. Your traditional Broadway scores, they often lean on classic structures, maybe some operatic motifs. Eddie Perfect wrote songs that are basically three-minute pop-punk tracks disguised as show tunes.
Okay, that explains a lot. I was listening to the cast recording, and tracks like Dead Mom or Say My Name, they don't sound like Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Not even close.
They sound more like Paramore or Green Day.
Precisely. They are engineered with what we call beltable hooks. They're high energy, they're emotionally raw, and maybe most importantly, they fit perfectly into a 15-second clip on TikTok.
You think that was intentional?
Oh, I don't think it was an accident. The music feels designed for a generation that consumes content in these short, punchy bursts.
So the music is the engine. But the story had to change, too. In the movie, the main characters are really Adam and Barbara, the Maitlands, the ghosts in the attic.
The musical completely flips that. The center of gravity shifts entirely to Lydia Dietz,
the goth teenager.
In the film, she's a great supporting character, a catalyst. But in the musical, she is the protagonist, and her motivation is, it's much darker. The show literally opens with a funeral.
Right, the song prologue, Invisible.
Yeah, that sets the tone immediately. Lydia is at her mother Emily's funeral, and she feels completely ignored by her father, Charles.
That feels like a heavy way to start a musical comedy.
It anchors the wackiness. The writers must have realized that if you just have a demon running around being chaotic for 2 hours, it just gets tiring. You need emotional stakes. And Lydia's grief, that drives the entire plot. She isn't just trying to scare people. She's trying to use the handbook for the recently deceased to summon her dead mom because she feels completely and utterly alone.
Which actually parallels Beetlejuice himself. He's also alone.
That's the clever mirror they set up. You have Lydia, who feels emotionally invisible to her living father, and then you have Beetlejuice, who is literally invisible to the living world. He's this millennia-old demon who just wants to be seen.
And he breaks the fourth wall constantly to tell us that. But doesn't that kill the tension? If the villain is just joking around with us, are we actually scared of him?
That's the trick. You aren't scared of him. You become complicit with him. When he sings the whole being dead thing, he's mocking the audience.
Yeah, he is.
He makes fun of the fact that we paid all this money to see a show about death. He mocks the whole idea that there's going to be some happy ending or a neat little life lesson. By bringing you, the audience, in on the joke, he creates this bond. We sort of become his co-conspirators.
It's like a stand-up set gone completely wrong. Okay, So what about the Maitlands? In the movie, they die in a car crash, right? Drowning.
In the musical, it's much more, well, domestic and kind of pathetic. They fall through unstable floorboards in their own home.
That almost feels insulting.
It's totally intentional. They're portrayed as these incredibly anxious, risk-averse people. They weren't ready to be dead because they never really started living. You know, they were just projecting all their insecurities onto their pottery and their home renovation, avoiding the really scary stuff like starting a family.
So when they die, they are terrible at being ghosts.
Truly awful. Beetlejuice tries to coach them in that song, Fright of Their Lives, but they can't scare anyone. And this forces a major plot change. Lydia actually teams up with them. Instead of being the victim, she becomes the active one, recruiting these ghosts to help her destroy her dad's new life.
Speaking of the dad's new life, Delia, in the movie, she's the stepmom, the artist. Here, she's a life coach.
It's such a brilliant update for the modern era. She's hired as Lydia's life coach, but is secretly Charles's lover, and she sings the song No Reason, which is just a masterpiece of toxic positivity.
Oh, yeah.
She tells a grieving child that everything happens for a reason.
Which is pretty much the worst thing you can possibly say to someone in grief.
It makes her this fantastic, non-supernatural villain, and the set design reflects all of this madness. We have to talk about David Korns' work.
I've seen photos of the set. It looks like a funhouse.
It's so distinctively Burton-esque, but made for the stage. The house itself becomes a character. As Beetlejuice's influence grows, the sharp angles get sharper, the colors get more neon green and purple. There's a fireplace that literally expands to eat people. It creates a visual language that perfectly matches the chaotic sound of the score.
So you have this high-energy, visually stunning, but also emotionally grounded show. It opens on Broadway, April 2019 at the Winter Garden Theater. Alex Brightman is getting Tony nominations. Everything looks great.
And then we hit the first death, the eviction.
I still don't fully get this part. The notes say they were breaking box office records. How do you kick out a tenant who's paying the rent and then some?
This is a brutal lesson in the economics of Broadway real estate. Usually, a theater owner can evict a show using something called a stop clause. If your ticket sales drop below a certain number for 2 weeks straight, they can give you the boot.
But Beetlejuice wasn't dropping.
No, they were surging. But the Schubert Organization, which owns the Winter Garden, had already made a deal years before. They had promised the theater to Scott Rudin for his big revival of The Music Man.
The one with Hugh Jackman.
So it didn't really matter how well Beetlejuice was doing. The Music Man was seen as a guaranteed gold mine, you know, with $1,000 tickets. So despite Beetlejuice pulling in $1.6 million a week, literally breaking the house record for that theater, they were told to pack their bags.
That's just heartbreaking.
Oh, it sparked a massive outcry. The cast was furious. The fans were furious. It really highlighted that Broadway is a real estate business first and an art form second.
And then the ultimate irony. They play their final fourth show at the Winter Garden on March 10th, 2020. They're homeless looking for a new theater. And then
the world shuts down. COVID-19. 3 days later, every single theater in New York goes dark.
So for a while, it really looked like that was it. The show is dead.
Dead and buried. A forced closing followed by a global pandemic is usually the nail in the coffin. Sets get thrown in dumpsters. Actors move on to TV shows. But this is where the whole zombie thing kicks in.
Because while the theaters were closed, the internet was very, very open.
Exactly. And this brings us right back to that pop punk score. During the lockdown, you have teenagers stuck at home. They find the cast recording on Spotify. They start making animatics on YouTube, cosplay videos on TikTok. That beautiful sound challenge went viral.
Oh, I remember seeing those. People doing the makeup transformations.
By the time 2021 rolled around, the album had surpassed 200 million streams in the U.S., 350 million globally. That is just, it's unheard of for a Broadway cast album that isn't Hamilton.
It's so interesting because looking at the critical reviews from 2019, they did not predict this at all. Ben Brantley at the New York Times, he hated it, right?
Right. He was brutal, called it sensory overload and exhausting. He basically said the show is just desperate to please, like a needy child. But here's the disconnect. The critics saw desperation, but the online fandom saw relatability. They saw a show about anxiety, invisibility, and chaos that matched how they felt inside.
So the producers looked at the streaming numbers and basically said, well, Ben Brantley is wrong.
Essentially. They realized they had a hit even without a theater to perform it in. So in April 2022, they pulled off the first Resurrection. They reopened at the Marquee Theater.
It's rare.
Extremely rare. Revivals usually happen 10, 20 years later. This was barely 2 years later with a lot of the same cast. It ran all the way until January 2023.
But they still weren't done.
No. They did it again. Just recently, they brought it back for a limited engagement at the Palace Theater. That opened in October 2025 and just closed last month, January 3rd, 2026.
So it has closed three times now.
Closed three times, resurrected twice. And this third run had Justin Collette, who had been absolutely crushing it on the national tour. It just proves that the brand itself is strong enough to survive these huge gaps in production.
Let's talk about that global spread. You mentioned 350 million streams globally. Does a show about a very American suburban goth girl translate to other cultures?
Surprisingly well. And I think that's because the character of Beetlejuice himself is an archetype. He's a trickster god. He's Loki. He's the Monkey King. Every culture has a myth about some chaotic spirit who comes in and disrupts all the social norms.
That's a really good point. You don't need to understand New Jersey references to get why a clown destroying a dinner party is funny.
Exactly. Physical comedy is universal. When Beetlejuice is being gross or levitating or possessing people, that works in any language. They've had successful productions in South Korea, two runs in Japan, one starring an actor just named Jesse, and a huge run in Brazil with Eduardo Sterblitch.
And Australia.
Yes, and the Australian production had the ultimate metacasting. The show's composer, Eddie Perfect, actually played Beetlejuice in Melbourne.
Wow. The guy who wrote the songs about wanting to be seen finally got on stage to sing them himself.
It's poetic, right. But speaking of chaos and acting out, we kind of have to address the elephant in the room, or maybe the politician in the theater.
The Denver incident, September 2023.
It's impossible to ignore because it just fits the brand of the show so strangely. You had U.S. Representative Lauren Boebert attending the national tour in Denver.
And she got kicked out.
Ejected. The security footage showed vaping, taking flash photos, and let's just say excessive displays of affection.
It almost feels like the show invites that kind of unruly energy. You have a demon on stage breaking all the rules, and then the audience starts breaking the rules.
It creates this weird feedback loop. Now, obviously, theater etiquette is important, and what happened was disrespectful to the actors on stage. But in a weird way, it was the most Beetlejuice thing that could have happened. It was chaotic, it was tabloid fodder, and it kept the show in the news cycle for way longer than a normal tour stop ever would have.
It proved the show is still a lightning rod. So where does that leave us today? It's February 11th, 2026. The Broadway production is dark again. Is the zombie finally actually dead?
I wouldn't bet on it. The Broadway run is over, yes. But literally, in 2 days, February 13th, a non-equity U.S. tour launches in Fresno, California.
Fresno, get ready.
And if you look across the pond, London is finally getting a turn. A West End production is slated for the Prince Edward Theater in May of this year, May 2026.
It just seems like as long as there are teenagers or adults who still feel like teenagers, who feel misunderstood, this show has a market.
That's the core of it. We can talk about the pop punk music and the real estate deals all day, but fundamentally, this is a story about grief. It takes the scariest thing in the world, death, the loss of a parent, and turns it into this giant neon-colored party.
It makes the scary stuff manageable.
It validates that feeling of being an outsider. Lydia eventually finds this weird, blended, undead family that accepts her for who she is. That's a powerful message, and that message doesn't really have an expiration date.
It's interesting to think about the legacy here. Beetlejuice might be the first true internet musical.
I think Be More Chill sort of started that trend, but Beetlejuice perfected how to monetize it. It proved you don't need the New York Times if you have TikTok. It completely shifted the power dynamic. Now you see producers looking for the next viral moment show, not just the next critical darling.
Which could be a good thing or a bad thing, depending on your taste.
It certainly changes the art form. It favors spectacle and, you know, memeability. But if it keeps theaters full and introduces a whole new generation to Broadway, it's hard to argue with the results.
So, to wrap this all up, we have a show about a bioexorcist, a spirit whose job is to get rid of the living. But in reality, the show itself is the ultimate survivor.
It's the reverse bioexorcist.
Right. It keeps getting canceled and evicted and closed and dismissed by all the serious people.
Mm.
But the fans, the living, keep summoning it back.
It refuses to leave the house of pop culture.
So is Beetlejuice the musical actually the ultimate undead monster? It just will not stay down.
As long as people keep saying its name or, you know, streaming its songs, it has a tether to this world.
Well, I'm not going to say it three times right now, just to be safe. But if you're in Fresno or London, you might want to. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.
See you on the other side.
Bye for now.